We continue our work now with our guest speaker, Kimberly Riley, who is a professor of history. She develops programs and teaches at the Center for Liberal Arts at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. She's an intellectual historian. I think Kimberly once said she was born looking backwards. It's just her natural orientation. She has a strong interest, and always has had, in the working out of ideas, or the qualitative or subjective realm, to see that realm conditioning world relationships and experiences is her forte and her focus as a soul. And so she's well qualified to address her topic, which is the Dignity and Rights of Man, a History of the Democratic Ideal.
Thank you. When Sarah and I talked about this topic, talking about some kind of history of democracy and human rights, I think she mentioned, or something she said put it in my mind, that it might be interesting to use, to see if there would be a way to use history, not just to trace back the antecedents of democracy and human rights, although that can be important, but to really use history to somehow strengthen ourselves for the work that we want to do in promoting democracy and human rights, and to find some way to use history to overcome what I think many of us probably experience at some point in our lives, which is a kind of discouragement that you see, you look around the world, you see things aren't perfect, it can be very frustrating, very, very upsetting in many ways. So it was one of the things I thought of when I sat down to talk about this topic was, what could we do, or how could we use history in some way, some active and alive way, to really strengthen ourselves as we go forward. So that was what was in my mind as I sat down to write this talk. If I were going to give a typical classroom of history of democracy and human rights in the West, at least, we would most likely trace the roots of these ideas to English philosophers such as Thomas Hobbes or John Locke, or to later Enlightenment thinkers such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Montesquieu, Voltaire, or Thomas Jefferson. An institutional and legal history would undoubtedly link the roots of democracy to the Magna Carta and to the glorious revolution of 1688, in which the English Parliament replaced King James II with William of Orange and Queen Mary, and produced a written Bill of Individual Rights. We could then discuss the American and French revolutions in the light of these precedents. However, this afternoon, I'm not going to follow this familiar path. Instead, I want to focus our attention more abstractly so we can begin to think not only about the lineage of democracy and individual rights in human history, but also find a way to generate the strength necessary to actively support these ideals in our own time. So let's begin our history, not with history as such, but with a paradox. If we think about the topic of human rights and democracy in a general way, we're immediately confronted by the following serious problem. On the one hand, we can reflect upon those historical moments when groups of individuals publicly dedicated themselves to living according to the principles of right human relationships. The Magna Carta, the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, the American Constitution and Bill of Rights, or the United Nations 1948 Declaration of Human Rights come easily to mind as examples of high human aspiration. On the other hand, if we know anything at all about human history or modern conditions, our faith in humanity's ability to sustain these ideals in practice over time falters. Countless dramatic historical accounts of abuse of power, exploitation, and war seem to overshadow periods of peace and justice. The actual events of the French Revolution illustrate this paradox perfectly. In 1789, inspired delegates to the National Constituent Assembly issued the Declaration of the Rights of Man, affirming the principles of equality, freedom, and accountable government. Just over 3 years later, these same idealistic revolutionary leaders, pressured by war, food shortages, and the king's defection, suspended the declaration indefinitely, using instead the guillotine to maintain their grip on power and punish any so-called enemies of the state. This reign of terror, which lasted from 1793 to 1794, claimed the lives of many of the revolution's most active champions for liberty and justice, including Camille Desmoulins, Georges Danton, and finally the terrorist leader, a very tragic historical figure, I think because of his genuine idealism, Maximilien Robespierre, inspiring the playwright Gerhard Büchner's famous phrase, "The revolution devours its children." What are we to make of these contradictions, not only in relation to this one historical example, but also in terms of human history itself? And more importantly, how are we to find encouragement for human progress when the historical and contemporary records often seem so bleak? Can we see any actual progress in human consciousness? Or rather, is it true, as the old French proverb suggests, I won't say it in French, I'll just translate it, the more things change, the more they stay the same? That's like a real question, I think, that many people often have. Just as individuals committed to the path of development need support and encouragement on their journey, so too do human groups. Yet this support, vital as it is to human development, is not easily found. The individual, in contrast, has the guidance and comfort of many fellow travelers on the path of spiritual actualization. For thousands of years, human beings in every culture have written and talked about the joys and pitfalls of personal development. When the individual stumbles, there are many other minds waiting to steady his or her course. When we think in terms of individual development, we readily accept that setbacks are part of the course. We learn not to despair when we glimpse our shadow selves. Our friends and our teachers counsel us. We stumble forward, eventually gaining confidence that our efforts do produce tangible results. Yet humanity as a whole has no such tangible guidance or comfort. When the group fails, there seems to be no recourse, no source of clear wisdom, no obvious pattern to show the way back to our ideals. The collective will seems fragile and easily fragmented in the face of the collective shadow or dweller on the threshold. History seems to show how easy it is to turn away from group aspiration, group principle, and to drop back into the more familiar worlds of selfish concerns. What is needed is the kind of guidance that would actually collectively bridge the gap between our own group aspiration and its actualization. We need to begin to think in ways that strengthen us and let us strengthen others for the continual work that is needed to bring our group ideals into material manifestation. How can the study of history in general, or the study of history and democracy and human rights, help us to gain inspiration for the collective progress of humanity? What thoughts might we develop on our own and share with others as a source of support for the group? What language might we invent for this collective strengthening? Currently, we stand at a critical juncture in human history. We who live in the world's democracies have learned the power of public criticism to unmask abuse. Many of the political, social, and cultural advances of the late 19th and 20th centuries are rooted in a free people's ability to publicly critique the status quo. And yet, as the history of the short-lived German Weimar Republic from 1918 to 1933, this was a republic in Germany between the two world wars, as this history shows us, relentless, virulent critique from both ends of the political spectrum often weakens the spirit of democracy, a spirit that can only thrive in an atmosphere of tolerance and compromise. By destroying the very relationships that a thriving polity's polity's engine, excessive critique exhausts the collective will to good. Democracy and human rights rely in part upon vigilance. They also rest upon an ability to perceive and foster the good that already exists in the human family. Yet what we're good at is criticism. We're quick to perceive failure. We're much less skilled in the art of collective strengthening. We hesitate, perhaps fearful of repeating the mistakes of the past. There was a time, for example, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when history textbooks were filled with heroic praise. The winning of the West, the conquest of Africa, the triumph of industrialism were routinely described as moral victories, leaving nothing but progress, and I say that in quotations, in their wake. In the aftermath of the Second World War, this kind of triumphalism was blamed for fostering chauvinistic attitudes insensitive to the reality of historical experience. Historians began to work with a more critical eye, seeking out more accurate and detailed information about the lives of ordinary men and women and analyzing the forces that shaped human experience from multiple perspectives. Critical history replaced the heroic at every level. Yet critical history, meant in part to counteract the old heroic style, often leaves us unable to see any human progress at all. Moments of idealism, such as in 1688 in England, 1775 in America, 1789 in France, or 1919 in Germany, are turned into a series of compromises. Vested interests suddenly seem to dominate. We can see greed, ambition, simple pragmatics, and all the other qualities that prevent the full implementation of the ideals articulated in humanity's best moments. Just like many young individual aspirants, we as a collective, whether we are writing history or just discussing world events, seem to vacillate between periods of overweening pride and overwhelming despair when faced with the record of our own group actions. It's time to begin to stabilize our thoughts about our own past. And this afternoon, I want to try to use some moments in the historical record, particularly the record relating to democracy and human rights, to suggest some direction for that process. To perceive growth, we may need to develop a more enlightened view of time. 215 years after Robespierre's revolutionary terror, France is a stable democracy. If we chose to look at any given segment of time between 1793 and 2008, we might have much cause for despair. Who would have thought that democracy or a democratic Bill of Rights could have possibly survived during Napoleon's reign as emperor, the restoration of the Bourbon monarchy in 1815, Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte's reassertion of empire in 1852, or the Vichy government's collaboration with Nazi Germany during the Second World War? Four Republican governments failed in France, a track record that might cause even the strongest idealist to lose faith. And yet the cause of democracy did not fail in France. Its establishment simply took far longer than its original champions could imagine. The development of German democracy confirms this pattern. Social democracy became an organized movement in the 19th century, although its leaders faced continual hardships and setbacks under Chancellor Otto von Bismarck and other conservatives. By 1914, however, Germany's Social Democratic Party was the largest in the Reichstag, and the country's collapse after the First World War made it possible for this leadership to declare a republic in 1918. Germany's first democracy lasted only 15 years. Economic collapse, constant attacks from both the right and the left ends of the political spectrum, and the Versailles Treaty's harsh terms immobilized this fledgling democracy, leading to the rise of the National Socialist Party and the democratic election of Adolf Hitler to power. Who, in 1942, for example, when Hitler's armies appeared to control most of Western Europe, could have imagined that just 3 years later, Germany would embark upon a second successful democratic initiative that would last for, at least at this point in time, 63 years. Because democracy is as much a series of habits and states of mind as it is an organizational system, group progress rests on the simultaneous personal moral development of countless individuals. While the individual may chart his or her own progress in years or decades, group development must necessarily be counted in much longer spans of time. 50 or 100 years should not seem excessively long to produce new habits, new ideas, and new emotional attachments in populations of people counted in the millions. The individual seems only a fraction, and that fraction may cause joy or despair depending on one's place in history. To perceive group progress, however, we must expand our normal perception of time well beyond the scope of our individual lives. We may also have to alter our view of the mechanism of historical movement and momentum. Historians and the public at large have traditionally associated the history of democracy and human rights, again at least in the West, with the revolutions of 1688, 1775, and 1789, all seemingly abrupt breaks with the traditional past. Most revolutionaries have also felt this sense of isolation from their historical fellows, a loneliness that springs from acting in ways that seem entirely new. Needing to strengthen themselves and justify their actions, champions of democracy often have spoken of the entire past prior to their efforts as corrupt, decayed, and bankrupt. to revolutionary founders and to many of us today, there's no relationship possible between democracy and the rest of the human past, or between democratic nations and the rest of the world. Yet this common view gives a distorted impression of actual change over time and leaves democratic institutions seemingly standing alone against a hostile humanity who often seems to prefer tyranny and abuse to human rights and freedom. Yet perhaps there's more relationship between the past and the present than is commonly supposed. Rather than abruptly breaking with the past, democratic institutions enfold the achievements of other groups into their own structures of ideas. Instead of seeing the past as divided into times of progress and times of tyranny, perhaps we should understand historical development as a kind of continuous conversation, an ongoing search to perceive, define, and express the principles of right and effective human relationships, a process that most people in most periods of time are in fact striving to do well. An example from ancient history illustrates this point. Let's go back in time to the year 1760 BC, or BCE, if you prefer that, nearly 4,000 years ago, and listen to a few of the laws inscribed by the Babylonian emperor Hammurabi, who promulgated one of the first written law codes in Mesopotamia, which is the area that probably most of you know as modern-day Iraq. For Hammurabi, this law code was a moral act, a standardization that would produce greater order and justice. He even invokes spiritual leadership in the code's prologue, stating, Anu Enbel called me, Hammurabi, by name, the exalted prince who feared God, to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land. On the one hand, this righteousness seems very far from our current standards of democratic and human rights, and I'm going to give you a sample of a few of Hammurabi's laws just to make this point. This is something he's written on punishment. If a fire breaks out in a free man's house and a free man who went to extinguish it casts his eyes on the goods of the owner of the house and has appropriated the goods of the owner of the house, that free man shall be thrown into the fire. So physical torture is a normal part of this legal system. Or if a free man has destroyed the eye of a member of the aristocracy, they shall destroy his eye. If he has destroyed the eye of a commoner or broken the bone of a commoner, he shall pay one mina of silver. So the punishment goes down depending on the value of the person. If he's destroyed the eye of a freeman's slave or broken the bone of a freeman's slave, he shall pay half his value. So at that point, it's only just about a property damage. There's no question that these laws fall far short of modern standards of right relationships. In Hammurabi's time, it was accepted as normal and righteous not only to punish through what we would call physical torture by throwing you into a fire or gouging out your eyes, but also to value human beings according to birth status. The whole code spells out different laws for different social classes. The system's righteousness, however, lies in its clarity and uniformity. The same standards are carried throughout the empire. The steles on which these laws were inscribed were set in temples and available to read or to be read aloud to anyone in the land. These laws are far from democratic, nor did they protect human rights in any way recognizable to us today, and yet they do contain two basic principles that will eventually be the basis of every democratic constitution and every Bill of Rights, namely that the same laws apply everywhere and that they must be publicly known. Hammurabi's law code, which seems so far from our ideals of justice and democratic principle, may in fact be just a first step in a long historical process of thinking out and regulating complex human relationships. Human social organization and philosophical thought, much like human science and technology, builds on the past, incorporating old ideas and adding innovations in increments. These new inventions, so to speak, in any human realm tend to be much less new than they appear at first glance. To illustrate this principle, we can move forward in time to the year 1215 and examine some of the ideas embedded in the English Magna Carta. The Magna Carta was issued in response to certain perceived abuses of custom and noble privilege by England's King John. Many of the assumptions regarding the different status of individuals based on social class that we see in Hammurabi's code are still present in this 1215 charter, much of which pertains to the economic rights of the wealthiest landholding barons. Like Hammurabi's code, a sense of the charter's rightness or righteousness stems from its uniformity. The new laws are to be applied in a like manner all over the land. The code is to be made known to the population and is to apply in perpetuity. The charter creates a stable and universal system, certainly a prerequisite to any more sophisticated conception of human relationships. It may even be possible that the concern with standardization evidenced in Hammurabi's code and the Magna Carta is directly related to democratic ideals. Both documents spend a considerable amount of time on the establishment of a universal system of weights and measures. The Magna Carta, for example, includes clauses such as number 35, which states, "Let there be one measure of wine throughout the whole realm, and one measure of ale, and one measure of corn, to wit, the London quarter, and one measure of cloth, to wit, two ells worth between the selvages of weights, let it also be as of measures." It's always easy to take for granted that what seems part of a fixed reality, such as a standard set of measurements, and forget the implicit intellectual relationship between these universal standards and universal standards of individual justice and freedom. How far is it really to go from the idea that all must receive the same measure of wine to the idea that all must receive the same measure of justice or the same measure of respect and dignity as human beings? The Magna Carta also offers significant new initiatives in which we can clearly recognize the beginnings of a democratic ideals and practice. Courts of law are to be established in fixed locations, only trustworthy tax collectors, sheriffs or bailiffs are to be appointed, and their prerogatives to confiscate property, commonly accepted before this time and actually long after by custom, I have to say, are curtailed by law. Imprisonment without proof of cause is abolished. The monarch is forced to accept that his will is bound by the law, and that most significantly, in Article 61, that a convocation of his highest barons could overrule his actions if they violated the charter's provisions. Twice it's stated that the English church is free from the monarch's control. While the charter may not have changed the life of the average 13th century peasant significantly, or granted individual liberty in any way that we moderns could understand, it did set precedents for the legality and limitations on executive power, limited taxation, freedom of religion, and equality before the law that would be extended and elaborated upon in subsequent constitutions and bills of rights in countries all over the world. By the 18th century, written constitutions, such as the American and French versions, extended the concept of rights to include the idea of individual liberty, a freedom to exercise conscience, initiate economic, cultural, or political activity, and to operate in a fixed and clear legal system to each male citizen. No longer do punishments or privileges attach to social class or hereditary status. In theory, each male individual is equal and free to operate as long as his actions do not harm the general good. There's a growing sense that physical punishment is unjust and unwarranted in most cases. Like Hammurabi's code, these principles extend throughout the land and are made clear to the whole population. Like the Magna Carta, the executive head of state is limited in power, taxes can only be levied according to an established legal procedure, and the church is conceived of as free from government intervention. American and French revolutionaries believed their work severed them and their fellows from the past entirely. Yet just as a tree's new branches spring from its older, healthier limbs, so too do man's newly conceived liberties contain the past's best offerings. There's power, I think, in thinking of our democratic and human rights ideals as firmly rooted in this way. If we can see connections between our current values and institutions and those of the past, we can then conceive of ourselves as working with the powerful flow of historical energy, rather than holding our fingers in a cracking dike that can barely hold back the tides of human tyranny and aggression. We can imagine that other cultures, perhaps more like Hammurabi's state than our own, are in fact not so entirely and hopelessly different. We can look for and find connections and can imagine that growth and development towards the ideals set forth in democratic constitutions and bills of rights are not aberrations in the human story, but are in fact natural parts of the human thought process regarding relationships between fellow human beings. Then when we, ourselves, or those around us, fail to live up to our ideals, we can find faith in the fact that the body politic, just like the physical body, has deep wells of healing power to turn a course of sickness back to health. History is just as much a tale of this kind of healing as it is a story of human aggression. As an example, let's recall the background to the first Geneva Convention of 1864. In 1859, Jean-Henri Dunant, a Swiss businessman, was having difficulty obtaining the concessions he needed from the French government to run his colonial business ventures. To further his own interests, he traveled to Italy to appeal directly to the French Emperor, Napoleon III, who was engaged in battle with the Austrians over the Italian province of Piedmont, Sardinia. Arriving at Solferino during the battle, he was appalled by the conditions of the wounded. Some 38,000 dead and dying soldiers lay unattended on the battlefield. Using the phrase, "all are brothers," Dunant organized local women to care for the wounded, using his own money and influence to obtain supplies. His book, Memory of Solferino, not only aroused public concern, but also became an inspiration behind the founding of the International Red Cross and the basis for the first Geneva Convention's declaration regarding humanitarian treatment of soldiers during wartime. Dunant would go on to win the first Nobel Peace Prize in 1901. Dunant's ideas were embraced first by local women who immediately attempted to help Austrian and French soldiers sent to conquer their own territory, and later by a wider, yet far from perfect, 19th century public in both America and Europe who responded instinctively to humanitarian ideals. This response, this determination to end the horrors of warfare, to extend decent living conditions to all, and to prevent cruelty and abuse wherever possible, is as natural to human beings as is the aggressions that sever our ties to each other. The horrors of the Second World War set in motion a similar response, culminating in the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Let us remember that the human response to ideals is ever strong and steady. It's natural for human imagination to run ahead of the ability to implement its own visions. Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks are a perfect illustration of this simple reality. Nearly 500 years ago, Leonardo laid out sketches for cars, airplanes, submarines, and parachutes, none of which were made to work in his own time, but all of which are commonplace features of our world today. Almost all human ideas of significance seem to follow this pattern. Cell theory, to take an example from science, was first articulated in 1663 by Robert Hooke, and scientists are still working nearly 350 years later to understand the full nature of human biology. We accept this incremental process of growth readily in the fields of science, medicine, and technology. No one would ever say that Hooker failed because he didn't immediately see the whole. No one doubts the whole enterprise of science when it fails to produce answers immediately. Yet we often doubt the process or possibility of human growth when human beings fail to see and implement the totality of right human relationships, either in the past or in our own present. And scientific understanding has been as vital to human welfare as has our own articulation of human rights. Pre-modern death statistics, with half of all children dying before their first birthdays, confirm the idea that abuse at human hands is only one of the sources of human misery. Perhaps one of the lesser-known strengths of modern science is its optimism in the face of imperfection or failure, its steady production, its refusal to give up on a problem until a solution is found, its willingness to accept better ideas when they come along. Perhaps those of us who want to promote human rights and democracy should take our cue from these other human enterprises and hold steady to our own vision of the human future, sure that right relations are a natural part of human living and that a vision of a more humane future will come to pass. It's also worth remembering that all of the major human rights documents have been descriptive as well as prescriptive. In other words, framers of famous bills of rights were not simply idealistically dreaming up new abstract standards for their fellows, but were in fact actually describing behaviors and attitudes that had already found their way into the public's consciousness. To take just one example from American history, Thomas Hooker, frustrated by the restrictions in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, left to found a new settlement in Connecticut in 1639. His Fundamental Orders of Connecticut, written 130 years before Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, limited executive power, extended voting rights regardless of religion, and protected religious expression. Hooker's work is only one of many such declarations and charters drawn up by colonists in the pre-revolutionary period. By the 1775 revolution, Americans had had over a century of practice articulating limitations on government and basic human rights, just as the French revolutionaries drew on the American example and their own 50 years of experience in democratically organized debate clubs and other learned institutions. It's worth keeping in mind that significant change only appears to rest on the actions of a few individuals. In reality, spokesmen and women arise at particular times to articulate ideas that have long resounded in the hearts and minds of a steadily growing majority. In other words, culture is just as, if not more important than political action in promoting and protecting democracy and human rights. Few of us have significant political power, yet we all wield influence over the direction of our culture and the climate of popular opinion. A large share of the fate of democracy lies in our own hands. My goal this afternoon is not to recommend an optimistic approach to human history. Optimism seems too breezy, too light an attitude to take towards the enormity of the human record. Simple optimism too easily forgets the sufferings of our fellows who had to stand in the dark places during spans of time marked by war, famine, and human cruelty. Optimism offers little solace for those forced into slavery when Athens fell to Sparta at the end of the Peloponnesian War, or during the long centuries of the Roman Empire, or when European colonists landed in Africa nearly 2,000 years later, or for those who watched their children slowly starve with no organized relief during the 30 Years' War, or the Irish Potato Famine, or any of the other numerous hungry times in human history, or for those who were slaughtered at the Battle of the Somme over yards of soil, or for those who were murdered at Auschwitz. These sufferings deserve to be recorded, pondered upon, and honored, not brushed away as preludes to better times. Rather, I would ask that we use our study of history to invoke the power of past right action, to find a way to stand with less fear and more love of humanity, to develop an intelligent understanding of the actual task of human group development and a language that supports the evolution of human consciousness. Even the very brief histories of democracy given this afternoon show us that human progress is never linear. The record shows that human beings voice ideals long before they have the tools to put them into practice. We must learn to know this fact and to understand its implications. We must come to expect setbacks and failures, even anticipate them. Then, when the group fails, as it inevitably will fail, when we read of practices of torture occurring in societies whose own founding documents decry such acts, when we discover that large numbers of people in all parts of the world still respect only power crudely wielded, when we find out that we and our fellows are not yet perfect and are unlikely to achieve perfection in our own lifetimes, we do not sit down in despair, but rather rise up, ready to act out of the ancient human determination to set the wrong right, confident that our present actions will bear future fruit. Thank you. So,
can we stay here? Or stay? Okay.